this is not information that is taught in public school. How do you deprogram yourself? How do you get rid of the head trash that like populates your brain that is an artifact of your childhood, that the brain isn't like evolutionarily adapted to dissolve on its own when it's out of that environment? That's where learning new modalities and new ways of deprogramming yourself and letting go of limiting beliefs comes into play. That's what I want to focus on, like pretty much in some degree, in some way, shape, or form for the rest of my life, I think, because that is the thing that makes the biggest conceivable impact. It's like if the beliefs are the origin point, the source of all of the feelings and all of the thoughts, and those feelings and thoughts are the origin point of all of the actions, then it's like beliefs is the highest resolution attack vector that you can use to program people and fuck them up. But then it's also the highest level way to liberate people and set them free.
Oh, hey, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to the School Sucks podcast. Today is Wednesday, April 14th, 2021. I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show my dear friend, Nick Runlett. Nick was last on the podcast back in August, even though I forgot about that episode during this conversation when we interviewed a Praxis graduate named Logan Westbrook. Nick is a Praxis graduate as well. That was how we met. Have I ever told you this story? I'll tell you again. I was at a party at friend and neighbor Zach Slayback's house. I'd been there for a while, and I suddenly had this awkward realization that I had talked to everyone at the party that I know. And I said, well, it's time to talk to people I don't know. But how do you pick when you don't know so many people at a party? I saw this young man. He looked very friendly. He looked very approachable. He was in a group of strangers conversing. I walked right up and I said, I'd like to join your conversation. And Nick actually knew who I was, and that was really nice. And we've been friends ever since. And we've done a number of collaborations. So I was thinking when we talked, Nick's last time on the show was back in March of 2020. That was the time. And he was the first of several casual, as casual as things could be back then, conversations that I had about, well, you know the thing. So now that we're a year beyond the tension of March 2020, I wanted to spend some time reflecting on that with Nick. We both had, I would say, a lot of positive growth experiences since then. And so that was the background for our primary topic in this show. But I'm not going to lie, it takes us a while to get to it. So part of my whole podcast production philosophy is if I can take 10 minutes of my time to save thousands of people up to, gosh, I don't know, 20 minutes, 30, 40 minutes of their time, it's a small price to pay for all that productive energy conserved. Now, I do ask for a modest contribution for doing things like this. You can go to patreon.com/schoolsucks or schoolsucksproject.locals.com and just chip in. You also get access to a ton of additional serial shows, including Picture of the Month Club, The Discomfort Zone, In Pursuit of Utopia, and the University Weekly Discussion Group calls, if I think they are lively, entertaining, and informative enough to edit and then repost on those platforms. But that's all extra time, and I don't ask people for extra time. I save people time. I ask you to support this show to help us project our message further. Lots of changes coming with School Sucks Project in the near future. I will only hint at today. Again, I apologize for my absence. I will not make excuses, but there will be little tidbits of information about where I have been, why I have been absent in the conversation you're about to hear. Now, all that being said, we spend a good 40 minutes on 2020, COVID, social unrest, those kinds of topics, conspiracy theories. And many of you might be tired of that, and you might be here for the topic of removing your self-limiting beliefs, something I've been thinking about, reading about, and talking about a lot lately. I am going to clap twice, and in between those claps, I am going to put a time code where you can jump if you only have time for that part of the show. I haven't lined everything up yet, so I don't know what the time code is. Once I find it, I will put it between these claps. Ready for the claps?
48 minutes and 30 seconds.
It's the least I can do for you. Do you know some people don't even edit? They just put out whatever happens. I couldn't even imagine this. You're saying, yeah, well, some people are much better at talking than you are, Brett. Fine. But you don't even actually know that because I edit. In fact, I'm starting to think this hypothetical, critical listener that I evoke sometimes in my monologues might be just a voice in my own head and not a real person at all. In fact, if I think about it for just a split second, I know that is the truth. And that's a great transition into what we're eventually going to be talking about in this podcast. So Nick and I spent some time going over this together, just in private conversations. He had some really interesting developments in his personal life. I said, look, we got to get you back on the show and do a kind of review and reflection of where we were at this time last year. I actually found a couple of clips of that conversation. I'm not saying you need to go back and listen to those. They were called Hi, How Are You, I think. And I talked to Nick Runlett, Nick Hazelton, Paul Verge, CJ Kilmer, and Tom Woods, just to kind of reach out to some people and see where things were at as we were all kind of on the edges of our seats around this time last year. But I started with Nick, and we'll talk about why in the show. So we do reflect on that, and eventually we'll move on to this topic of removing self-limiting beliefs. And we make a neat connection between the inner world and COVID world. But that's coming up later in the show. Again, we are a listener-supported project primarily. The links again, patreon.com/schoolsucks or schoolsucksproject.locals.com. We also are going to talk a lot about our private community, the University, in this conversation. If you're interested in accessing that, you can go to ssbuniversity.com/ideas into action. And if you say, I want this, I not only don't want this product, but I want to be part of this scene, use the coupon code MySpace and I'll see you inside. We got a book club coming up. We just did a film club meeting. We just did a crypto club meeting. And we talk every Sunday. So there is still space. We are short of our cap for that community. All right, here's my conversation with my friend, Nick Runlett. His website, and he's going to mention this again at the end of the show, is mastermindarmy.com. You're going to learn all about that in our conversation as well. Thank you for listening, and take care. I'm not going to say, you know what, let's just start. I'm not going to say, how are you doing, like at the beginning of a show, because I know how you're doing. We've been talking for a half an hour now, but Nick Runlett, welcome back to School Sucks Podcast.
Dude, Brett, so happy to be here. Thank you, man.
The last time you were on the show, it was March 18th, 2020.
Yeah, there was some things happening in the world right around that time.
So you were one of the people that I was following. I'll tell you who the people were. My webmaster, Tony, who was in Sacramento, California. So when the whole pandemic, he and I were talking about it on February, and he was saying, you better get serious. You better get on Amazon, start getting your cans of stuff.
That's right.
And started to see things happening in California before most of us did in the rest of the country. I was listening to you. We were talking, but you were also posting a lot about it online. And I was taking my friend, Kevin Geary. Do you know Kevin Geary?
Actually, yes. I met him in your Sunday meetup.
Oh, wonderful. Kevin was posting a lot about it as well. So you became my three go-to guys, and you and I had a conversation. I think I called it something like, it was a whole series. It ended with Tom Woods. I did five episodes where I thought the right tone for a year ago, it was last March, but the series of these conversations went into April, was like, let's get people that we know and care about on the phone and just have real conversations and connect and say, how are things where you are, and give each other some support and also some talk about what we were doing to get ready for what we thought was coming. And a lot of stuff did come. It was quite a year. I thought when I listened back to it, I listened back to it earlier today, I was like, I'm going to cringe at myself a lot in that show. But there's some pretty good prophecy in it too, as far as like how the world would change. I asked at the end, I was like, Nick, are you worried about anything else that we didn't get to? And you said, yeah, I'm kind of worried about how the government's going to respond.
Yeah, that's kind of fair.
One thing I haven't even given myself the time to really think about or process is like, I'm worried that the state, meaning broadly state government, local government, federal government, they're just going to use us as a freaking power grab. And there's going to be a lot of unconstitutional shit that's about to go down, forcing mandatory quarantine. There was some guy who refused to self-isolate after testing positive in Kentucky, and they sent the armed guard to go and like watch over his house. That's going to really suck. And we have no idea, once things get really bad and we head into the several hundred thousand cases nationwide, like what is going to happen?
These are not new fears to us, right? We've talked about these things probably, or at least I have on the show, and I know you're certainly in the same ballpark politically. We've talked about these things for a while, and we've sounded the alarm on these things when they seemed small and meaningless to most people. Yeah, I think it should be my project to just gather more information about what kind of measured response people are thinking in the event that that does happen, or if the response can be measured at all. Obviously, the most successful way, I mean, this is a 2,000-year-old cliche, sorry, to achieve that is to divide people, to divide a population against themselves.
Yeah, we just have to stay mindful that the cold, hard reality is that there's going to be a lot of change, and we don't know.
Yeah, and returning to normal, I would almost say it's not a valid expression, right? Because when things stabilize, right, when an equilibrium is found, the world is going to be different. Maybe, possibly, it could be much better, or it could be on the path to getting much better. And there's a lot of bullshit right now, as you're saying, just to kind of pick up on like the wheat from the chaff thing. A lot of bullshit, I think, might get blown away by this. I think people are going to start asking lots of questions about decisions they make, how they live their lives. People are hopefully going to embrace an opportunity to be thoughtful in ways that maybe they haven't before.
The more people that look at this as an opportunity to improve, the more likely that positive outcome will be.
But a lot of the show was very much about like prepping, hygiene. It was about prepare yourself emotionally to go into the supermarket and see all the empty shelves. But I don't know. I mean, we started talking about doing this show a couple of weeks ago when it was right about the 1 year anniversary. And we're finally getting it to it today in the second week of April. And I reached out to a couple other people that were in that run of shows where I took a break from numbered podcasts and just had these conversations. But I wanted to start with you. The conversation that I had with Tom Woods, where he's like, you know what? I'm kind of starting to think there's a lot of BS here. That was first week in April. And it actually was one of the inspirations for a whole series of shows that I wound up doing between, I think, May and July with my friend Daryl Becker. And we called the series This is a Test, where Daryl brought a very, very skeptical eye to the whole COVID phenomenon and narrative and the public and political response to it. And I'm really, really glad we did that. So he and I will probably revisit that within the next month as well. But I would say, I think it's fair to say that there we both were, third week of March, kind of on edge. I had just within a few days of recording left my home in Pittsburgh and returned to New Hampshire, which I thought was a safer place. It really didn't matter. Unless I was in the wrong part of Pittsburgh in May for a day or two, it really wouldn't have mattered where I was the whole time. But by this time last year, I had fled into the wilderness, thinking that I was going to watch the world burn in April 2020 and all of that month, nothing happened at all. Then in May, I went back to Pittsburgh to gather my stuff and temporarily move back to New Hampshire. But last thing, now I'm kind of in the wilderness again. I'm just renting short term in this old, charming but filthy Rust Belt town called Butler, which is about 25 miles north of Pittsburgh. And I'm splitting my time between here and Pittsburgh. And man, it is a clash of civilizations. But we'll talk about that a little bit in a bit. So I want to hear how, since our last recording, I know this is a big question, and you can, you know, highlight whatever you want and leave out whatever you want. How has that year been for you?
Oh boy. So I think there's this weird phenomenon. It's like time dilation. It's like more and more human experience feels like it's happening in a shorter and shorter period of time.
Oh, well said. And yeah. Yeah.
I have felt that since, I don't know, I became like actually sentient and conscious.
That it just keeps, there's a quickening that's, it's like, yeah, always accelerating. Yeah. Yeah.
There's that general trend. And I feel like that just doubled in the year of 2020. And that was a really full year. So I struggle to even think of answering. So how was that entire year for you? And I'm sure a lot of people listening feel the same way. I started working remote in sales at a software company. I built up the sales organization from them. I started a relationship. There was so much stuff. It's like a lot.
I would say it was definitely a personally educational year for me. Yeah. You know, I had, around this time last year, I had some falling outs with really good friends over COVID and response to COVID kinds of things. It took a while to like patch those relationships up. There were numerous causes, but it was certainly filled with challenges that I feel like I'm a much more grown up person after.
Yes.
Now you're much younger than I am, but I think what I've gotten from our private conversations is you're very much in the same boat.
Yeah, 100%. Like the amount of maturity and mental fortitude that came out of 2020, I think, is immeasurably good.
What's the biggest lesson that you'd want to share?
I mean, tying back into that initial conversation that we had, don't call the dogs home too early or something, right? Like, it was interesting because, right, like all the early indicators from data that was coming out of China and data that was coming out of Italy seemed to show on paper, like, oh yeah, this is a really big deal and we all need to be very concerned about COVID-19. However, in my estimate now, I think that it's really just being used as a global suppression mechanism for human consciousness and free will, and governments and states are using it in order to just control the local population at any cost. So whether it was a crisis that was manufactured or a crisis that was taken advantage of, it doesn't matter. The end result is that the loss of like human liberty and human connection of people and children growing up fundamentally scared to see bare faces, it's completely immeasurably more damaging even than I think the human lives that have tragically been lost from the illness itself.
Yeah, I remember in the show we said something like, the worst case scenario, if we're wrong, is that we'll have a whole bunch of extra food and water. So we have a whole bunch of extra food and water. But when I listened back to it, I said, was there anything that would happen that we really could not have imagined? So I was kind of trying to outline, like, what have the biggest changes of the last year been? And I think we hit them all, right? Like the government response, the usefulness of this, the division that it would create in society that was already well on its way by the time the pandemic hit, or everybody was forced to become aware of it last March. The one thing that we really didn't touch on, and in fact, I think we really had it wrong, was, you know, I think we were both saying something like, this will be the time for the free market to shine. We'll see how adaptable it is, right? Like private enterprise. And they have really, I don't want to say they've eaten shit, because all the biggest corporations are certainly doing just fine in the midst of all this. But their response and their collusion, both with the state and with a kind of political culture, has been immensely disappointing and in some ways quite frightening.
The thing is, like, it's a great consolidation of wealth. If you already had wealth in 2020, you became fantastically rich. I got to taste a little bit of this with crypto, and everyone who was in real estate and everyone who was in stocks and everyone who owned assets saw the value of their assets in terms of dollars just skyrocket, like absurd. And so the very richest corporations that had the very highest, you know, ability to lobby for exceptions and be deemed essential, they did out so well. And then the mom and pop shops, you know, tens of millions of them across America, they just got kind of completely wiped out and consolidated. And I think that, that part of it, I attribute malicious intent. I think that that's too convenient.
Now, you've hinted at this a couple of times, but have you developed any... Are you entertaining, maybe would be a better word, any overarching theories about the intention of what we saw over the last year? Like, for example, this lab leak theory that Brett Weinstein, the biologist, has been promoting is very compelling. He's gotten a little bit of play for it here and there. The former director of the CDC actually echoed the same idea recently on CNN. But this is kind of like something that people are not supposed to talk about, the idea that this could have leaked either accidentally or intentionally from a lab in Wuhan. And as I've watched efforts, mostly from mainstream perception managers, to shape certain narratives, to highlight certain things and to hide other elements in the shadows, I have grown incredibly suspicious as to what is actually going on here. So I thought maybe we could bounce some ideas back and forth. It's an interesting contrast to a year ago. I think we were really both taking what we were hearing, and I don't know. Like I listened back to a couple of the conversations that I had around that time, and I was kind of mystified by how much I was taking what was coming out of the actual fucking television playing cable news stations. I was taking it for face value, you know? And I don't know if you felt the same. Yeah. I mean, we were looking beyond that, right? And I obviously go to my network first and I say, I trust this person. They've proved to be a competent thinker and a reliable researcher. But, you know, it wasn't until I think James Corbett might've been the first person who's like, this is fishy, right? There's a whole kind of culture developing around, the promoting of restrictions, horizontal policing, it was pretty much right from the beginning. I mean, Corbett might have been on that by the end of March, but it still took me a while to, you know, it was the conversation with Tom Woods, it was the conversation with my friend Daryl, and maybe a couple of other alternative media exposures here and there that had me going by April. What I'm seeing. It might have taken until May. It might have taken until I kind of reintegrated in the world by going back to Pittsburgh for a whole month where life just felt totally normal, that the things that are being presented are not matching my real world experience. But I did myself a real disservice by fleeing, in many ways, the real world to a point where I couldn't even see what was actually going on. You know, I couldn't even do a compare and a contrast. So, I mean, I was feeling more suspicious by May and June, sent forward by those influences that I talked about. But, you know, we've had at this point, and man, I did a ton of research on this for that series that I did with my friend Daryl. And after that, by the summer, I was very, very suspicious. But it has been a real challenge to put forward any kind of overarching or unifying theory about everything we're seeing. And that might just not be possible. I mean, there could be political factors. There could be like social psychological factors. We entered into the record a book called The True Believer. Are you familiar with that book?
No, I'm not.
Oh, it's just about mass movements, the psychology of mass movements and how they spin out of control. And that started to become very relevant once the racial component came into this. Because I think we could see that this was going to exacerbate division. But back when we had that conversation, we didn't see how, right? We both mentioned it in the conversation, but we couldn't see how it happened. So if you zoom out and you look at the political, the social, all of the things that have kind of played out in the last year, are you entertaining any kind of unifying theory, or are you just kind of taking it piece by piece and saying, yeah, this could be a whole number of things that are contributing to what we're seeing right now?
Yeah, it's a really hard question to answer without thinking like in depth, but I will give my general sense. And my general sense is just one data point for anyone listening. My general sense is that the timing of this all happening is very interesting. It seemed to be the case that there was a lot of potential for human consciousness to expand at a quickening rate, and people were becoming more self-aware, and mental health and going to therapy and getting self-actualized was like on the cusp of becoming a normal thing.
What do you think was the catalyst for that? You think that was just sort of a general upward trend that we'd seen in society over the 20th century? Okay, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And so like what COVID represents in the aggregate to me is a global consciousness and human connection suppression, like grid of control. And it's enforced vertically and like immorally through government. And then it's enforced horizontally through ostracism from people who are plugged into the matrix. And it really is making the world kind of like a living matrix where the people who are driving around in their cars wearing masks, they're plugged into that whole belief system. And they're diametrically opposed to you expressing human freedom because they believe that it makes them unsafe. And so it's very destructive. And it's obviously being used to, again, concentrate wealth into the hands of the super giga top 0.0050s more 1%. I don't view anything good coming out of it other than those who are already conscious and awake and see through it. Now there's kind of like a very easy and obvious like filtration mechanism for whether or not someone is conscious and thinks for themselves, generally speaking. And it's worn on everyone's faces.
Yeah. And I didn't know if like in the libertarian world, just to that last point, if we were all kind of falling into a honeypot where if this was a more coordinated, and now we're getting kind of doom and gloom here, and we have much more silver lining for the audience
for sure
than we did in our last conversation. You know, we're going to talk about adapting, and we're also going to talk about the building of parallel institutions, which has become, I think, far more motivating and far more necessary against what we've seen in society over the last year. So we're both working on projects like that. But yes, first, the honeypot idea, which I talked to a few people about, where you'd see some kind of news event happen where the so-called experts would be proven wrong. And then a bunch of people would take a kind of victory lap, right? Like, ah, see, look, this Fauci is full of shit, or he doesn't know anything, and why are we listening to these people? And it was kind of the first, before the racial component came into the picture with the George Floyd thing, the real division was over masks, right? And the anti-lockdown protesters that were mostly centered in Michigan, but there were replays of that in several states around the country at that time, where it was like Trump-supporting idiot versus responsible science person. That was sort of the division that the media was trying to create. And there were staged incidents of, you know, nurses blocking traffic en masse, who these people really were, if they were even nurses, nobody knows. But there were manufactured photos and a very manufactured narrative about this. So that appeared to be the first kind of split, and that was visible a year ago. And it still persists today. And I see it in real life in a city that is, you know, more politically to the left. I think that this broke out very cleanly for the last year along political lines. But the honeypot was, we would all step forward and say, this is bullshit. Stop doing this. Stop listening to these people. Stop wearing masks. Stop, sanitizing your fucking groceries. And then something worse would come along. And we would be held out in the spotlight as the people to never listen to again. And I just mean that whether that's conservatives, small governments, people who don't want to, you know, stand in line with their heads down and masks on, waiting for permission to go into a grocery store to get food, like those kinds of people with some respect for like individual liberty and autonomy, versus, the authoritarian culture that, again, is lining up more and more with left politics, which, you know, it's hard to tell what that even means anymore, because that side of politics is pretty fractured over various things as well. But yeah, I mean, that was a real concern of mine, that we were kind of being called into the spotlight to be permanently shamed as like freedom is dangerous and selfish and irresponsible, right? The idea that we shouldn't accept that we need to be told what to do, when to do it, when we can leave our houses, what we have to wear when we leave our houses, that's a dangerous and stupid person. And I'm glad that hasn't happened yet, but that doesn't mean it's not going to happen.
I just wish that people understood that freedom is dangerous and government authoritarianism is deadly. Mm. And there's a distinction there. Like, I just wish that people knew that this is better.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then it wouldn't have to be a honeypot. That's an interesting idea, though, right? Like, the concept of like the loudmouth libertarian who is telling people not to wear masks, he is the one who must be shamed because he is making you unsafe. I think that something else that's happened with COVID is that I personally, I live in Austin, Texas. I see people who just are they're wearing masks while they're driving in their car. They're walking outside in broad daylight. They're wearing masks. But I also have seen parties of 70 people, none of whom are wearing masks. They're all happy, healthy, successful people on average, just having a grand old time. And it seems to me that there's like this great social schism where I see people who are in a table, like at a restaurant, and they're all wearing masks at the table. Or I see people on 6th Street in downtown Austin, a group of guys, and they're all wearing masks. And then I see another group of guys that aren't. And it's like people are gravitating towards their in-group. And again, the masks, I don't know what lines they divide on. It could be left and right, but there's something there.
I think it's very clearly left and right. And it's like, so here's my experience, and you might have a similar experience for where you are in Texas, right? Mm-hmm. Austin's a very left-wing, or it's becoming that, right? I'm not mischaracterizing it. But 15 miles outside of Austin in any direction, it's a very different culture. And the same is true in Western Pennsylvania. So, you know, if I'm exiting Pittsburgh neighborhood after neighborhood, you know, it's like the yard sign with the platitudes on it. It's just like house after house after house after house. You know, if you're a passenger in a car, you close your eyes for 10 minutes, you open them again, and then you're just looking at Trump signs and flags. Like, still Trump 2020 signs up in people's yards 10 miles away once you get outside of the city. So yeah, you can feel a huge difference in the culture and behavior around this thing. And I think this is worth pointing out. I think most people understand this by now, but if people have been locked in the city or the country and they haven't seen this contrast and they don't see it day in and day out like I see it, and this is nothing against, like, I still love Pittsburgh. I love going to Pittsburgh. It's one of my favorite places I've ever been, and there's so many reasons for me to go there. It's certainly a personal internal project for me to not just tolerate these things, but also not give attention and energy and most of all anger to things that are outside of my sphere of control. I'm not going to be able to intervene with those people. I'm not going to be able to knock on doors and say, you see that sign in your yard? It's basically just like you doing a mirror, mirror on the wall. Who's the fairest of them all? Like, I don't have a good intervention for any of that. So I should give up the idea of even letting it bother me. I have to admit that it does bother me, though, because there is a culture that threatens my freedom more and more building around that and gaining momentum around that. And it seems to be that there's a lot of powerful forces lining up behind this. And this is really, really accelerated just in the last few months. Like, I thought January 6th, where there was this incident at the Capitol that people are using all kinds of different words to describe and all kinds of different terms to describe the people who did it, like, that was a turning point. For me, that was like the Charlottesville of this decade, right? What it was, I don't know, but it sure as hell felt a lot like a PSYOP, right? Where it said, we're bringing all these people together to create an avatar of what a Trump supporter is right at the beginning of his administration. So these are the people who will define, you know, the opposition to the cathedral. Right. If Trump is this kind of renegade figure who gives the middle finger to the media, the left wing establishment, academia, the culture warriors, here are his allies. This is what the opposition to the social and political established power structure in this country looks like.
Racist murderers.
Right. People who carry torches, chant "Jews will not replace us," and drive their cars into people. Right. That's the alternative to the cathedral. And that is how Trump's first term kicks off. It ends with this thing that happens at the Capitol, where it's almost like saying, hey, don't forget about these people, because now all this witch hunt energy that we've directed day in and day out towards Donald Trump, it's not like we're changing our business model at the New York Times or the Washington Post or CNN or Twitter. We're just distributing it to all our ideological enemies. And that was accomplished very effectively, where it's almost like we saw, I mean, gosh, you're probably too young to remember this, but a lot of the way the world looked and felt, you know, in 2001, it was it was like that. It was, but now it's like, oh, I'm the person that they're after. Is that a psyop? Technically, I don't know, but it certainly, you know, had all the same effects. So I've wandered quite a distance away, but I'd like to hear your thoughts, and then we can get back on track.
Yeah, well, I think that 2020 was just a year of psyops, just repeated psyop after psyop after psyop. And at this point, it takes, I don't know, I feel very disconnected in a great way from just kind of like the mainstream media lately. I've just had too much going on in my personal life to really care. And so I haven't been following news as much. And now that I think about it, this is all like verbal processing out loud. Like, that's been great. Just like not being in this deluge of like clear and obvious propaganda and then subtle propaganda that takes mental energy in order to discern. And it's like, who's running the psyop against which faction at which moment in time? It's really exhausting and not fun to waste your time and energy on.
Yeah, that is definitely true. And I don't know about, are you still on Facebook?
Yeah.
So I got off there in February. I would say that's been a huge plus in my life. And I actually found myself on Twitter today, just briefly. And I think I might have been combing through looking for some items that we could discuss as far as like where things are now a year later with all of this. Because now, you know, we're to vaccine passports, right? Like that's the big story that I think a lot of people in our world are really trying to mobilize against. And I think that's certainly worthwhile. So I'm just on Twitter looking around. Maybe 5 minutes go by and I'm like, how could anybody spend more than 10 minutes a day, even on here? You know, never mind. Like I haven't seen what's on CNN in months, if not all year. But it almost the last time I saw it seemed like a form of psychological torture. I think I see what that mindset looks like as it shows up in the real world from a lot of the behaviors that I can see in various parts of Pittsburgh, or maybe what you can see in Austin, as far as the fear and the. But is it? See, here's the thing: is it even fear? Is it just like this thing that I wear on my face is me carrying my yard sign around with me? Like, I don't even know if these people are really fearful. I think this all might at this point just be performative.
It's possible. It's definitely going to be a mix, and it depends on someone's like baseline neuroticism and level of anxiety.
Yeah, I don't think I should try to make any generalizations, because obviously like people, they're different ages. They have different you know, levels of risk. They might have known somebody who had it. They might have known somebody who died from it. Like, I mean, when we talked last time, I don't even know if anyone in the United States, I think like the death count was under 10 people
the last actually, time we talked.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Oh my God. What has been going on for you since we last spoke that's been just like really inspiring and uplifting and good?
All right. Well, I think one of the biggest pieces of that is this idea of parallel institutions, building parallel institutions. And it kind of comes back to, you know, social media, I think, was useful for a lot of us for a while, especially as like content creators. It was a great way to promote the stuff that we were doing, have discussions about, you know, what we were talking about on our show, generate interest, all of those kinds of recruit guests. I will say I've taken a hit, you know, from not being there, right? Like, engagement is obviously down because I've lost a major source of engagement. Downloads are down for the first time pretty much in the history of the show. I saw like a downward trend in trackable downloads for the podcast. So support is down for the show. So like having that Facebook group and being able to engage with potentially thousands of people, it was a huge plus. But I think I left it on principle, right? Like I said, this is not a place for us anymore, and I want to move our discussion somewhere else. So in 2019, I had built not even really a community, but just like a digital product that had some ways for people to stay involved if they wanted. And it was pretty dormant through most of 2020 while I focused on the podcast and various types of adjustment and readjustment in life. And then when I realized that it was time to not be dependent on Facebook anymore, I really started putting more time and attention and energy into building that community. I can't go into too much detail about this yet, and I'm certainly respectful of any detail about what you're doing that you don't want to go into here yet, but I'm working on another community around a new digital product that I'm building with my friend Nathan Frazier, where he's worked in marketing. My background is in education, and these are basically two trades which are very much installing a kind of programming in people. And we're interested in, can we put together, the sum of our knowledge into a way to help people remove the programs that are still limiting them, even if they have done personal development work, even if they are experiencing all types of personal and career success. People still feel like things are holding them back. You're successful for a young man, for sure. You might feel that way too. Like you still have things that you just haven't figured out yet, right? Mm-hmm. Here I am much older than you, at least 15 years older than you, and I'm in the same boat, still trying to break through certain barriers that I still have. So we want to build not just a training, but also a kind of support and accountability for different types of people who have these mental blocks, these negative programs, these self-defeating ideas, these barriers they haven't broken. Put them together with people who have broken those barriers, right? And maybe they've broken a barrier that the person who's broken the barrier that they haven't broken hasn't broken, right? So people can come together and say, hey, I've solved this, you've solved that, let's work together. And that's all kind of led with course material that he and I are currently in the process of putting together. And that's about the most I can say about it now. We're going to start rolling that out over the next month or so. But he and I, for the last half year, have already been doing a monthly series called Emotional Manipulators for Hire, where we look at how marketing tactics can become visible in perception management, right? In propaganda. And we compare and contrast the two, almost like, here's how you could use the tactics against you, not just identify them, but use them for good in your own dealings or towards your own aspirations. So he and I have a nice running start for what we're doing. This University community, we meet every week. We've built a number of clubs. We just did what I thought was a phenomenal discussion in our film club on Martin Scorsese's Last Temptation of Christ. We're getting ready to do a book club meeting on this book called Why We Drive, which kind of warns about the dangers of automation and loss of freedom on the road, but kind of scales that beyond just driving. We have a documentary club. My friend Alex and I did a crypto club, which I'd love to get you into at some point. And you're in this community as well. So there's lots of interesting things going on there. And I'm currently trying to figure out my role in like letting it take shape organically, letting people make connections, letting people break off into the clubs they want to have and the connections they want to have with certain people. But I'm really, it's a small group so far. I capped it at 200 people and we haven't reached 200 people yet. But I think that's like the manageable amount for the kind of institution, we'll say, that I'm trying to create, where people could know, like, and trust each other. And it doesn't mean in a group of 200 people, if we reach that ultimately, that everybody's going to be friends and everybody's going to feel a high level of like and trust with others, but they'll find and make better connections with maybe the people that they've been looking for, maybe the people who aren't in the areas that they're in. So we meet every Sunday. And those meetings are fairly unstructured. But one thing that I always like to make a space for is if people need some visibility or some support for the kinds of alienation, right, that have become all too common just in the last year. I mean, certainly we know from our vantage point that that's nothing new, but it has certainly been exacerbated by the events of 2020 and 2021. So I feel like that kind of support is really important. And, I see the University as a place where people can exchange ideas, get support, and if they enroll fully and they get access to the virtual summit, I think they can get some really good skills in a short period of time. Like, all this stuff is certainly spread out through the podcast over the last 12 years, but as far as like how to gather, assimilate, and present information in an effective way, that was the product that we built the University around. And we'll have more offerings in the future, I'm sure. But what Nathan and I are doing is actually a separate thing, which is really like, all right, now that you have this foundation, let's figure out how to break the final barriers you have. Right. And I feel like we're, leaders there that are not too far ahead of our followers, because, we still have barriers we're trying to break ourselves. So, and, we did a mastermind about it yesterday. Mastermind's another thing we can talk about as far as a positive. But, everybody, tremendously successful people on that call, all identified with like, yeah, there's still further I can go. I still feel like there's things that are holding me back. And, I'm really, really excited about this being the kind of thing that, takes me beyond what I've been doing for the last 12 years, which in a lot of ways has become very comfortable. And, things need to be stepped up.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited for you too, Brett, because like that's such a paradigm shift to move from educating people to impacting people, right? Like when you're talking about foundationally removing the limiting beliefs and psychological blocks that hold people in chains mentally, and like giving them ways through connecting them with people who have solutions to like actually find a way out, they're going to be really fucking happy.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's like, holy shit, what better thing could someone contribute the rest of their life to, or like a substantial portion of their, intellectual energy and capital to? I really think that's awesome.
Right. And it's not going to be for, everybody who followed the podcast, right? It's not going to be for everybody who downloaded the show, or everyone who followed on Twitter or Instagram, or who wanted to join the Facebook group. I'm talking about, taking a select group of committed and motivated people forward, and actually surrounding myself with the kinds of people that I want to know and that I hope to help and that I hope can help each other. And, it's not like I'm done podcasting. But I think this is the logical next step from, where I am right now. So there's two directions we can go there. I know you are working on a similar type of project, and if you want to go into any detail about that, I'd love to hear it. But we can also talk a little bit more about the self-limiting beliefs and how to remove them, which I know is something that we recently had a really interesting – I've had a few interesting discussions about this over the last month as I've immersed myself in trying to figure out the direction of this new program with Nathan. But do you want to start with your own – I guess we could call it parallel institution?
Sure. Yeah. And I'll be super brief about this because I think the limiting belief stuff is honestly more interesting. Mastermind Army is a network of peer problem-solving sessions. Basically, that's what a mastermind is you get a whole bunch of people who are super smart in whatever field or domain that you are interested in or a part of, and you guys get together and you help each other solve problems. And we're doing that for sales, entrepreneurs, and real estate investors up front. And it's still a work in progress. I've got 3 masterminds running right now, 1 for each of those domains. My vision is to expand it to many, many dozens. And if that sounds cool, or you have any questions for me, go to mastermind.army and drop your email in to the little sign up bar. Cool. We've talked about Mastermind Army. Limiting beliefs is a very, very, very interesting subject to me. And I personally have gone through a program called MindFix, which they've basically combined at least 3, technically in their like super elite program, or whatever, there's more, 3 methods, including liminal coaching, the Leftco method, and somatic experiencing. They combine all of this into a program that basically completely removes limiting beliefs out of your subconscious. And it's like deleting them. Like once they're gone, they're gone. And I feel like in self-help circles, like Tony Robbins, you hear like, it's all about your beliefs. But there's no like embodied sense of what that actually means. So I like to describe it like this. Human beings are kind of like a computer. And when you hit Control-Alt-Delete on a Windows machine, it opens up the task manager and you can see 78 different processes, 78 different programs running all at the same time.
In the background.
In your brain.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Your brain is doing this with all of the beliefs that you have. They're constantly taking up resources because a belief is really just a lens through which you view reality that informs your brain what kind of emotional response it should create in the body to some kind of stimulus. So said differently, if I believe dogs are scary and I see a dog, I feel scared. And that's what the belief is telling my brain to make me experience. If I believe dogs are cute and I see a dog, I bend down and I feel love in my heart and I want to pet it, because that's the belief that is operating in my subconscious or whatever. So when you have a belief like, I am not good enough, I don't deserve love, that was operating in my background every single waking moment of every single day and influenced all of my interactions with other people and myself constantly. It'd be the equivalent of a program that's taking up a whole bunch of RAM and disk space and CPU on my computer and giving me nothing good in return. And so when you close that program out and you delete it off the hard drive, boom, it's gone. You feel a lot better. And it, like, it actually ends the anxiety, the depression, the self-sabotage, the feeling inadequate, the feeling not good enough. The origin point of it all is beliefs. And it's crazy to think that there are people who have figured out how to just delete them.
Yeah, in a practical sense too. Like, if you have a background belief, right, a background program that generates fear and anxiety, man, I know this for a fact, you are sapping so much of your energy and attention. Like, so much of your productive potential is lost by that thing. Because it is like, hey, you know, it doesn't like come out and form itself in front of you, right? And say, here's what I am. Here's where I came from. You know, here's why I persist. But it's fucking there, right?
Yeah.
And it's in your way. And like, you know, I still have these. I recognize that. And I think there's a lot of people who enjoy plenty of success, you know, career, financial, relationship, like all kinds of success, who are not free of these things. So the first crack that I think a lot of people will have with something like this is cognitive behavioral therapy, for example, which spreads into a lot of like personal development and self-help kinds of programs. And it is, useful, you know, if you keep it at the front of your consciousness and you remember it as a tool, it is useful, but it's also like fairly surface level. So like, right, one of the most common tools in CBT is called ABC, which is like, there's an activating event, there's an installed belief that may or may not be recognized, and the activating event forces the belief that creates a consequence. So in the exercise, in the process, which is a repetitive process every time it's needed, you try to put in a challenging or a disrupting belief in the place of the installed belief to produce, you know, a more desirable, maybe even optimal outcome. But it's still not getting to the root, to the installation point of the belief. And another shorthand that we use very, very frequently, and this has been applied more to like encountering things in the political or philosophical or cultural world, is, you know, between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space lies your ability to choose your response. And in that response is your freedom. So that's a paraphrase of the quote. It's often attributed to Viktor Frankl. But most people believe that it was originated by Brian Tracy and just attributed to Viktor Frankl. But that is something that in almost everything that we've done on this show, from understanding logical fallacies to critical thinking to the six pillars of self-esteem to adverse childhood experiences, it is the process of trying to widen that space, right? And to kind of inhabit that space in a way that is useful, where a better response can be chosen. And the response is not just in what you do, but how you feel about it, right? Because you could also wind up in a pretty significant form of self-denial, where you're still kind of just following, like maybe you're acting like you're going to act differently, but you're still operating on the same belief patterns, right? Based on that program that's deeply, deeply installed. So it sounds like, and I know because we've actually gone through a couple of these exercises together in private, that this is more about getting to the place where the installation happened.
Yeah. The way I would describe it is like, if I were to continue the computer metaphor, beliefs are programs, like an executable file. When you right click and then hit properties, you can see how much you believe the belief. And one of the key characteristics of being able to let go of a belief is to move it first from certainty into doubt. And the way that you do that is you go back to the source trauma and you start providing alternative interpretations. Like my dad yelling at me as a kid, maybe it didn't have to mean I'm not good enough. Maybe it meant that he was really suffering from his own like psychological illnesses and his own, unresolved trauma. And he just didn't have the ability to love me in the way that I needed in that moment as a child. And you stack on several of those alternative interpretations. And then suddenly, maybe it's not like the ultimate end all be all truth that I'm not good enough. And then you go through a process of actually realizing that you created the belief in your mind. The source data that was passing through your brain did not mean and did not create any sense of I am not good enough. All I saw was my dad yelling. That's all I saw. I didn't see anything else. So if I didn't see anything else actually happen, it means that I made up the belief. And now you've been granted agency over creating the belief. And in many cases, that's all that's needed. It's like you reinterpret the source trauma and realize, oh, I can doubt this. It is safe to doubt that this is true. And then realizing that you never saw, you just made it in the first place. Boom. In many cases, the belief can vanish. It sounds abstract, but it fucking works. Well, it's really crazy. It works.
So again, we can kind of tie this into 2020 where people are hastily trying to make meaning of a very like rapidly changing. Everything is always urgent. Everything is always a crisis or an emergency kind of world.
Super quick, actually. Like the best example that just popped in my head, I've heard these before. It's Santa Claus.
Okay.
Can you, like, you don't take 9 years to learn that Santa Claus doesn't exist and stop believing in Santa Claus. Someone sits down with you and they have you a conversation with you and they say, well, what made you believe in Santa? Well, I saw presents show up. Okay. But what if that was just your parents? Oh, well, I guess maybe it could have not been Santa. Did you ever actually see Santa?
The doubt. Yeah.
Yeah. The doubt. And once that steps in, you unlearn that Santa exists in an instant and you never have to, you never relearn it. Mm-hmm. It's not like it just pops back into your brain once that happens for a kid. And that's pretty much what Mindfix does, right?
Well, yeah. But even if an emotion, like let's just call it an unpleasant emotion, right? Mm-hmm. That's driven by this deep-seated belief. It still serves a purpose, right? As an instrument of making meaning. Right. So it might suck, but it's an explanation. It's kind of like that's the tie-in with 2020. Like, yeah, this might suck and it might make me angry or scared or whatever, but it's an explanation to make sense, which is just almost this like subconscious impulse that we have, right? Like I have to walk away from this piece of stimulus with a response. And I learned through 15,000 hours of institutionalized schooling that stretching that process out is just kind of a pain in the ass. So if I can close that space to a second or two or 5 seconds or a minute at most, or like a, you know, one news package on my most trusted news network to make sense of it, that's what I'll do. And, and we all have our heuristics. We all have our shorthands. That's not being derisive to people who are, you know, stuck in mainstream media world. Like I've talked about numerous experiences that, you know, I started this show as a real fucking know-it-all and learned that I was wrong about a great many things that I was promoting with a great amount of certainty, just 10 years ago. And I remember as social issues came more to the fore around 2014 and we saw a developing kind of culture war, things that were happening in the Middle East, I would see stimuli, right? Like ISIS or Michael Brown. I mean, 2014 was a very educational year. And I would say, I know what this is, right? But I didn't. I was wrong. I was just trying to take a heuristic and put it on top of an entirely new piece of stimuli and say, oh, this just fits an established, comfortable pattern that I already have. I didn't enjoy any of that, but it gave meaning to it that was enough to move on to the next thing. So we just went through a year of perpetual crisis. I think a lot of people live, in their internal landscape, maybe not in perpetual crisis, but frequent crisis. I was listening to my friends from the Online Great Books podcast. They were doing a show on Kierkegaard, and one of them quoted Kant, who said, if the human mind was designed for happiness, it was a very poor design, right? Now, that could be cynical. That's certainly open to debate. But it's if you look at the trials that most people live with inside their own heads, it's certainly worth considering seriously, right? That if the human mind is designed for happiness, it is a poor design. So none of these programs, none of these beliefs have to result in happiness. They just have to result in some kind of meaning made. That's why maybe they persist unchallenged, right? Because they're just, even if they suck, they're useful tools. They get the job done as far as moving from stimulus to response and on to the next stimulus.
Yeah, they get the job done at the time that the like source trauma or source experience happens. So like when we're kids, and the safest way that we can operate in the world is to internalize everything and to imagine that everything is our fault. Those beliefs get formed so that when dad is yelling at me, I believe, oh, it's not dad is crazy. I'm fundamentally unsafe in this home. It's I'm not good enough kind of thing. Right.
So yeah, can I just jump in and say that it is one of the shittiest beliefs that persist through life, right? Because it's like, I'm unworthy. Everything is walking on eggshells. But at the time where the belief is installed, it's incredibly useful because it translates to safety. And the same is true with school, right? I'm not in a temporary prison that my parents lock me up in and don't question like what goes on here. And, you know, I'm an incredibly dangerous place that's supervised by people who certainly don't care about me. You know, I mean, I'm sure that varies. I know there are teachers who care more than others, but it's not a nurturing and caring environment by any means. But this all has to be safe. This all has to make sense. I've been welcomed here as long as I follow the rules and behave. And if there's some kind of conflict with that, it has to be a problem with me, because if this system is broken, if this institution, if this building has something wrong with it, I'm in incredible danger.
Right.
So the same is true at home, right? Right. My parents can't be crazy because they're keeping me alive. My parents can't be even imperfect, I think, if we're young enough, right? Mm-hmm. And I've had it out with people in my family when there were – oh, let's say I have siblings who made poor choices about who to procreate with. Like, I'm sure the people out there can identify. And talking to nieces and nephews, once they reach an age, I said, why should they even be forced to try and accept the illusion that this person mistreating them and neglecting them is a good person and can't be criticized because it's their mother? What sense does that make? Because they're just internalizing it as their own defects, right? If this person neglects me, what's wrong with me? Yeah, at a very young age, it's a belief that leads to safety. But once people reach a certain age, you have to do what you can, I think, to jettison that belief.
Yeah. And it's hard because like this is not information that is taught in public school. How do you deprogram yourself? How do you get rid of the head trash that like populates your brain that is an artifact of your childhood, that the brain isn't like evolutionarily adapted to dissolve on its own when it's out of that environment? And that's where learning new modalities and new ways of deprogramming yourself and letting go of the limiting beliefs comes into play. And yeah, that's what I want to focus on, like pretty much in some degree, in some way, shape, or form for the rest of my life, I think, because that is the thing that makes the biggest conceivable impact. It's like if the beliefs are the origin point, the source of all of the feelings and all of the thoughts, and those feelings and thoughts are the origin point of all of the actions, then it's like beliefs is the highest resolution attack vector that you can use to program people and fuck them up. But then it's also the highest level way to liberate people and set them free from all of that stuff.
So a lot of what we've talked about as far as the process is concerned is covered by something called the LEFCO belief process, which is basically a therapeutic questionnaire and tool that LEFCO therapists would go through with clients to identify these deeply installed beliefs. There's also the LEFCO stimulus process, which is used to interfere with the occurrence of a specific negative of emotion that is always caused by a specific kind of stimuli. So LEFCO is LEFKOE, And I can include a couple of these worksheets. You can find them online if people want to learn more about this. And Nick, you're welcome to say anything else about it that you want. But once we get through that, I do want to ask about the process of like inventorying these beliefs. Like how do you really identify and find them? Because they do become so comfortable and they do run so deep in the background that a lot of people might be kind of frozen as far as like where to start even digging. To like, I mean, we might get some sense like, yeah, I have this self-limiting belief around finances or worth, or we might have an essence of what these things are. But is there a kind of excavation or inventory process that you would recommend for people who might just be a little confused about where to get started?
Yeah, I do. And that's a great question. Super quick. I do want to give a quick shout out and plug to MindFix. They're at mindfixgroup.com. They are the origin point for me experiencing belief work for the first time. And they, my understanding at least, is that they've taken the Lefkoe method and they've built upon it. And they focus pretty much exclusively on like high achievers and entrepreneurs, and they've made it into a like really badass program. So there's a little bit of like a differentiator there that I just wanted to like throw in for the audience in case people are curious.
No problem. It's like your alma mater, Praxis, yeah, right? Yeah. I'm happy to promote them for no financial reward.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I've heard you say great things about MindFix, and our mutual friend Joel has I know engaged a lot in that with you. So he's obviously a big endorser as well. And I know a few other people who've been involved with various parts of the process. So yeah, that's great. I mean, if that was your origin point, I think that's definitely worth putting into the record.
Perfect. Yeah. And now let's talk about how to identify where these beliefs show up. So there's a super useful tool. Here's an example. Let's say that, you know, anytime that you're about to jump onto a podcast or interview a big guest, you feel a tension in your throat. You feel an anxiety in your gut. So what I would say is like, close your eyes and think about right when you're about to open up the Zoom, or the moment that the guest, the big important guest, pops onto the Zoom. Slow down time and feel out the feelings in your body, and then listen for the thoughts that come up in between each moment of like what is actually going on. And this isn't necessarily a real example for you, Brett, so I'll just make some thoughts up. One thought could be, holy shit, what is this person doing spending their time with me? Another thought could be, I'm not ready. Another thought could be, I'm not good enough. I don't deserve this. There's so many different thoughts that could come up in those moments. But the exercise is you go to the very moment when your negative pattern is about to get triggered. You slow down time in your mind's eye and you listen for the thoughts that show up in real time, like moment by moment by moment. And that will typically reveal to you several beliefs that can be gotten rid of. I'm not ready can actually also be stored in the brain linguistically as a belief that operates in the background. But I'm not good enough. I don't deserve it. These are also beliefs that can operate in the background. So that's one super useful way. And another super useful way is sentence stems. And so the sentence stem is a tool developed by Nathaniel Brandon. For those in the audience who aren't familiar, you basically start out with the first half of a sentence, like what I learned today is dot, 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 except for it's way less trivial than that. But you write down as many answers as you possibly can to that sentence fragment.
Not right. Ultra thoughtfully either, right? Like
no.
You are just accepting the prompt, and like depending on what kind of sentence stem work you're doing, like in his book that is mostly sentence stems, The Art of Self-Discovery, I think he's suggesting like 12. But you're not, there's no process of analysis or questioning what you're writing. You just let it go and move on to the next one. And then there'll be time for evaluation later.
Yes, yes, yes. And so I would look at whatever the dysfunctional pattern is and make a sentence stem out of it that says, in order to X, I would have to believe dot, dot, dot. So in order to be afraid when a big guest comes on, I would have to believe dot, dot, dot. And then you would write down a whole bunch of different answers of, you know, I don't deserve it. Who's he to talk to me? What about it? I'd have to believe that I'm not good enough to run this interview, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So those are two ways that you can you know, kind of like a visualization based way and then a free flow of consciousness writing type of way.
Excellent. How'd you feel about sharing just an example of like one that you were able to identify maybe that surprised you?
Ooh, yeah. Sure. Let me think. Oh, I think a really big one is I can't trust myself. Mm. That was a very powerful belief. And where I learned that was being a little kid, and my dad would always call me out to help him with different things, like work on this car with me, build this thing with me, do yard work, whatever it is. Anytime that we were working on the car, doing something where like I would have to screw in things or hammer something, or like whatever it was, using tools, he would look at me, he would watch me do it, and then he would undo it and then redo it himself so that it was how he wanted it or whatever.
No explanation. So you kind of had to make your own meaning out of what that was about.
Exactly. You would just undo it and redo it always. And so I'm like a little 5-year-old kid. I just clearly can't trust myself to do things right. And it's crazy how that belief gets stored permanently as a general sense of self-internalized distrust until it is fully resolved and basically deleted, let go.
So there's the origin, right? So I guess the follow-up question would be this. How do you make that explicit in the now, right? So how did you get the sentence from observing, I guess it would start with behavior and then trying to open that space, right? Or slow down time, like you said, which I think is great, and process what's happening in that space to ultimately wind up with the sentence, right? Which gives it the handles, which gives it the shape, however, whatever metaphor you want to use there. I don't trust myself to do things right. So you, at this point, you clarify like what the belief is, but what did you have to work with? So like, these are the behaviors that I notice. Mm-hmm. These are the places where I fall down or I'm not happy with my performance. And this is the space that I open up, and it ends with this sentence. So we get to from the starting point, but then I guess now we're talking about the sort of therapeutic encounter with something.
Yeah. This is like the more meta. So a baseline of self-awareness is extraordinarily helpful for this, but all you have to do in principle, Brett, is know what the patterns are and notice them that you dislike them. So the pattern that came up for me time and time again is whenever I'd be making a promise to myself, I would feel this nagging sense in my gut of like, you don't believe it. You're full of shit. You're not going to do it. You're just not going to do it. And that internalized general sense is something that I ran through that other process on of like, all right, so I'm like making a promise to myself. What is the language that pops up if I slow down time? It's like, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. And then you can abstract that a little bit into the kind of language that a 5-year-old would say. 5-year-old wouldn't say you're full of shit and you're not going to do it. 5-year-old would probably say like, I can't trust myself. And then when that resonates as true, you can say the belief out loud. And if you're in tune with your emotions or your feelings or your body, you actually feel like, oof. Yeah. That feels true. Right.
Yeah.
That's a good benchmark.
Maybe part of it too is like, I don't know what to do, which I think is super, super common as a place to just sink into cement.
That's also a belief. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what to do. Well, okay. So that is definitely a helpful starting point. And you'll kind of like sign off if people are interested in learning more in looking at some of the LEFCO resources for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if people want to shoot me an email directly, nick@runlet.com, I'm always happy to hop on a call, talk about any of this. It literally fills my heart up to help people do this type of stuff because it made a really big fucking difference in my life. So yeah, always happy to connect around it.
So in our conversation a year ago, we talked about self-care and adapting. Mm-hmm. And I think we covered that in both like becoming better in the midst of a closer to home crisis than maybe many of us had ever experienced, and kind of using that as an opportunity. And that was like inside ourselves, but also what we're projecting of ourselves out into the world. And we talked about that too, as the parallel institutions example. We talked about our prophecy, the prophecies that we kind of made last March, and where we were right and where we were wrong. In the midst of a discussion about the seriousness of the pandemic itself, I said I never wanted to be wrong more about anything in my life. So congratulations, March 2020, Brett. You were wrong about a lot of it. And, you know, the other thing, too, that we actually talked about as far as like what we could do inside our sphere of control to stay healthy. We talked about fitness, right? And I had just like when we talked on the phone privately while I was driving from Pittsburgh to New Hampshire. So that was like March 13th. And then we recorded a few days later, but that same week. And I remember being like, I don't know what I'm going to do like about the gym. I think I'd figured it out by the time we talked. I had like got my old kettlebells, and I was really excited to be able to, once I got to this sort of lax culture here in rural Butler, Pennsylvania, in December, actually like go back into a gym and start lifting weights again. Yeah. The sign in the gym says, no matter what Governor Wolf says or decrees, we stay open just as we are. And I said, this is my place. But, you know, I'd been working out with like giant rubber bands through all of 2020, and that was getting a little bit tired. You've been doing CrossFit?
Yes.
This is a CrossFit. This is a young man's game. This is
yeah, indeed.
It's, so I've always wanted to meet a sane person who does CrossFit. I know our friend Zach did it for a while, Zach Slayback. Yeah. But tell me, just for my own selfish curiosity here, maybe many people in the audience don't care, and that's why we left it towards the end of the show. How did you get into this, and what are you getting out of this?
So my friend Hannah Frankman was big into CrossFit for years, and she still loves it. And the way that she described it is like, yeah, there's just a whole bunch of really badass people, and we do really intense workouts, and we're always pushing ourselves to become better. And I think, okay, that sounds nice on paper, and I ignore it for like 3 years. And now I decided randomly, like, man, I want to get into something that's more intense than just like apartment complex dumbbells. right. And so I found a CrossFit gym that's nearby. And apparently there are CrossFit gyms where there's like very low regard for safety and like good form and proper warm up and stretching. That has not been my experience. The gym that I went to, it's called CrossFit Strength Haven. It's in Austin, Texas. Highly 10 out of 10 recommend. These guys are awesome. Their coaches like double and triple down on helping you for the first several months, like master your form and make sure that you're not exposing yourself to any risk of truly injuring yourself. And then they're incredibly supportive, and there's just a great community of people who are all there trying to become more physically healthy. And what I love about it personally is that A, it cures my ADD for like the entire day. And they've done studies that show that like cardiovascular exercise in particular has very positive minimizing effects for ADD. But B, I have gotten so much stronger. Like I haven't tested my one rep max for deadlifts or squats in a long time because I had a back injury going into this. And so they were able to coach me on how to get stronger through my back injury. I can deadlift like 315 and I can squat 230. Those are like 50 pounds higher than like I'd ever been before. And that's just after really like 3 or 4 months of going maybe on average twice a week. So you get pushed to the limit and it's really profoundly good.
So I had heard stories about people doing CrossFit like 6 days a week, right?
And I
looked at some of the workouts and I said, that is insanity. Not to be confused with another fitness program called Insanity. But
that is P90X. Yeah.
You know, I've been going 3 times a week, and I've been doing this thing called dog crap training. And if anybody likes weight training and is looking for something new and fun and filled with variety, I would recommend this. It's just named after some guy, Dante Trudell, his nickname in bodybuilding forums in the 90s was dog crap. So it got named that. But it's like pretty low volume. Like you're not doing, you know, people will go and they'll be like, today is chest, and they'll do like 12 or 15 sets or something crazy like that. You are doing one set 3 times every 2 weeks per body part, right? Hmm. But it is like you are going to war for the 2 minutes it takes. They're called rest pause sets, where you take 3 consecutive sets to failure, right? With very, very short rests. So it's a lot of compound movements. There is a risk of injury. It is not for old folks. And, you know, I'm 43, so I actually, and I'll go through these kind of bulk up phases where I'll gain a substantial amount of muscle for a small boned 5'10", you know, I weigh 172 pounds, and my joints and my bones will start to hurt from the weight that the muscles can support, but the joints and the bones can't. So then it's time to kind of revise. So I actually am super proud that I just found a way to modify this to actually increase the intensity, right? Like the muscle fatigue while taking stress off joints by doing what's called negatives, right? Like slower reps, because you get into this thing, which is very much about linear progression, right? Where you're always trying to move more weight every time you repeat a workout. You'll repeat the same workout every 2 weeks. Right. So you want to move more weight. And if that becomes the priority, you can vary, especially if you have a partner that you're competing with, like I have, you can get sloppy with form. So I just modified this to do more reps at a slower pace, like 4 second negatives, like on the down portion of whatever the movement is, the eccentric portion, you're just counting for four down, which means you have to drop all the weight. Right. So the ego is out of it. And you're really, really, really becoming more mindful of what you're doing. And I really, really love that. And that was actually one of the benefits when I started doing more of those like compound or powerlifting type moves. You really, really have to be engaged, right? If you can listen to the School Sucks podcast at the gym, God bless you. But I have been going with no headphones, even if I go by myself. No headphones since I went back at the end of December. And I'm as strong as and in as good a shape as I've ever been, you know? And that was one of the, I wanted to get that on the record because it was one of the commitments that I made in that show is like, I'd figure out how to stay fit. And yeah, I maintained with my rubber bands throughout 2020. But and went back to the gym and was like, wow, rubber bands are not the same thing as weights. And I realized how weak I was. But it took, you know, about 3 months to exceed where I was last March when I stopped going, you know, to get stronger. And but also more confident. Like I was dealing with a SI joint problem. I had medial epicondylitis. I couldn't even curl a barbell. And, you know, now we're back to doing like weighted pull-ups and all that. And I got some help from somebody in my community who actually turned out to be an elbow doctor and sent me a course on how to heal medial epicondylitis, which is golfer's elbow. But so I could go on and on. Maybe I need my own podcast about this topic. But yeah, I honored my commitment to emerge from 2020 more fit. So sounds like we both did that.
Yes, yes. And emerged stronger, healthier, and wiser people in the end. So a very fitting ending to that whole chapter.
With all kinds of survival food that we didn't have to eat.
Yeah, I've got my InfoWars 3 month food supply. So
I listened to the show. I listened to that show earlier today and you were waiting for some shipment that there were no updates on. I assume it came.
Yes, it did. It ultimately came and it looks great. It's in tubs.
Well, we should not wait a year between recorded conversations. We certainly don't wait a year between private conversations. And I'd love to have you back soon. We can talk about anything, Nick.
Yes, that sounds utterly brilliant. It would be super fun at some point, potentially, to run through the belief elimination process live with you. That would bring my heart joy.
I will do it. I will absolutely do that. I will volunteer myself. I will throw out a limiting belief that I still possess. And we can do that. Yeah, we can do that in the near future. I also wanted to just give you a chance to mention what you're doing this weekend, since we have plenty of listeners in Austin and the greater Austin area. It is Praxis weekend down there, right?
Yeah. So Praxis is having a get together down in Wimberley, Texas. And basically, it's just going to be all the participants and alum. I'm pretty sure that like non-participants and alum, unfortunately, are not welcome.
I know, but is there like a way to meet up with people? Like there was a bar nearby or an after party or something like that?
I suspect that a lot of folks, so it ends officially Sunday morning. A lot of folks stayed the entire week and they'll be leaving like next week. So I suspect that there's going to be a lot of stuff going on Sunday specifically.
And it's tricky because Wimberley is a far ways away and it's not really like a bar town or hip town or whatever. I'm sure that a lot of kids have different plans and stuff. But yeah, definitely if folks are in town, shoot me an email.
That sounds awesome. In February, I went down to Charleston and I texted Isaac and I'm like, I'm in Charleston. Let's do a show. He's like, I live in Tennessee now. So being in a place with a bunch of Praxis people sounds awesome. And if you, I don't know, maybe you'll all meet in a bar somewhere. So that's very cool.
Yeah. Who knows?
So does the event have any kind of focus or is it just a, you know, occasional alumni and participant gathering? And that's the focus.
I feel like it's more of a casual gathering. There is nice. Some, you know, they'll run like workouts or not workouts, workshops and breakout sessions. And I'm actually going to do a live sales mastermind with a couple of my buddies who are alumni of the program as well. And so that'll be a fun breakout session to do. But yeah, other than that, it's just connecting. I'm hosting a Praxis poker night, which I'm very excited for.
You're a poker guy?
Yeah, yeah. We're going to have like $1,000 slinging on the table, man. It's going to be great.
Put it under the table. Don't have it on the table.
Yeah. Well, we'll use chips and everyone will Venmo me. I'll be the banker.
Yeah. We kind of had trouble figuring out how that works.
So it's really simple. It's so that you have the chip values and you know what they are and everyone just Venmos you their buy-in. And
Venmo to a pot. Venmo to one person. Then the person distributes it. Right. Bingo, so we the last time we did it, it was like we all felt real dumb because we were trying to like no one Venmoed anybody. And then we were trying to I had to take out a piece of paper and said, okay, based on the initial like buy-in of this – and like people wound up owing each other $12.50 and it was weird. But yes, you're right. Everybody Venmo's one pot solved. I love it. So yeah. There you go. That's extra wisdom that came out of this show. So Nick, thank you so much. Is there anything that you want to leave my audience with as far as ways to learn more about you or what you're doing before we're out of here?
Yeah, I'd say follow me on LinkedIn, linkedin.com/in/Nick-Rundlett. Draw me an email. If anything that I said today piques your curiosity, I would super love to connect with you. And then if you would like to join a mastermind group, whether you're in sales or you're a real estate investor or you're an entrepreneur, they're going to be free all throughout the month of April while I'm building this product. So if you want to surround yourself with a whole bunch of, you know, successful entrepreneurs who are starting new ventures, already succeeding in their ventures, or sales professionals who are killing it, crushing their game, real estate investors who are getting started, already have, you know, a million in assets under management, please join us. I would absolutely love to meet you. And you get a free pass into the community if you're friends with Brett. So yeah, I would absolutely love to have some School Sucks folks in there. And that's mastermind.army if you go and sign up there.
Excellent. Also, drop by like the university meeting on Sunday at 10 Eastern if you can, since you're in that community, and mention that because I bet there's a lot of people there who'd be interested.
I bet you're right. I will.
All right, Nick. Thank you so much.
Amazing, amazing. See you soon, Brett.
Strip down to your